I'm really happy to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass for the first time, Brian Sutton. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm great, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Hey, listen, it's something I've been angling for a way to find in a while, and the new album, The More I Learn, was a perfect opportunity. And I'm just thrilled to get a chance to speak with you a little bit about it. I think the title of the album, and we'll talk about this a little bit in just a second, but I really do think that you're telling, don't try to get too deep into it, but I've listened to all the songs at length, and you really are sort of making a statement. But I want to say this first. Last time I saw you was with Hot Rise, and I know that wasn't the last time you performed. How do you find time? Because I know you're always on tour or appearing in studios to put together what is the 13-song collection here of The More I Learn, which, by the way, was released on Sugar Hill, I think June 3rd. How do you find time to do that when you're doing all the other business that you're doing?
Well, I've just tried to make a habit of not getting myself into sticky situations of double booking. And that's part of the, you know, it is the juggle. My life and career have been a juggle, you know, since I got out of high school and started doing recording sessions and doing some live playing. And that's just sort of come with the territory over the years. And, you know, anybody that does anything like I do or, you know, owns a business or maybe owns a couple different businesses understands that, you know, you can get overwhelmed. But I've tried to just maintain a balance of things. Balance is a big part of my just philosophy in life, and try to just keep, you know, be aware of kind of global things of what my time is or how my time is used in certain things. That's sort of the big picture. But, you know, to get specific, it's, you know, it's managing your calendar on a week-to-week basis and understanding that things move around. And thankfully, you know, I'm not in a position where there's lots of people calling all the time. There'll be certain things, certain way things are done. For instance, you know, live shows are generally booked, you know, 6 months in advance on average or something like that, where a recording session might not get booked, you know, within a month or so of an actual date, sometimes a week or so within the date. So usually, you know, there's these big things that happen on the calendar, and then there's holes, and those holes get filled the closer I get to the date.
Yeah.
And so, again, back to the big picture, what I've tried to do is just sort of see what's coming up. John Hartford, I always like his quote about driving a paddle wheel. He says, you drive a paddle wheel boat by looking a mile down the river. And it's sort of like that,
okay,
where it's, you know, I'm aware of where I've got to be. I know I got to do today, but I'm also kind of aware of what the next 6 weeks look like. And so anyway, so the big picture of that is, you know, family time. It's okay, I got to go make a record, and I know that I've got a window up in November, and there's this big Hot Rise tour, so I can use some of my time in airports, planes to work on song selection and writing and things like that. I did a lot of the writing on this record on, you know, in my seat on an airplane.
You know,
kind of tweaking.
And it actually kind of, there's a feel to that. And I will tell you that as we're looking through there's 13 songs. I count 7 that you either wrote or co-wrote or had a hand in.
Sure.
And to follow on what you're just saying now about your life and the importance of, you know, timing and scheduling, Hills for the Head pretty much says, you know, I'm going to be busy, but I'm going back home again. And those are the things that you draw from, the ocean and the hills that you go. It's a story about basically, I would say, a busy musician or whatever, but still taking the time to go back home and visiting all those things and replenishing your soul, I think, the way I hear the song. I don't try to be too deep, but that's the way I read exactly what you're telling me about managing your time.
Yeah, it's great. The day-to-day awareness of what I'm doing, how much I'm doing something, I tend to get burnout. I've been really fortunate to not do one particular thing in my career. If I do too much travel, I usually get burnout. If I do too many recording sessions, I get kind of antsy to get out and play bluegrass. And so, again, I'm trying to strike a balance of the two things. And then also, like I say, having family time or time to get back home or go to Telluride for a few extra days and just kind of decompress. You know, you got to allow time for all that kind of stuff. And I think most people that aren't professional musicians, you know, draw from some sort of sense of, let me just have some time for myself. And if you don't, you probably need to. That's my advice.
Of the 13 songs, and some are traditional, Arkansas Traveler and Secesh, which I think must be a song about the Civil War period. It's either that or A River in Idaho. So I was looking up what it was about.
Yeah.
Am I right about the first guess?
Okay. The Sesh, I'm not sure if it's about a specific state, but it's, you know, it's the secessionist sort of behavior there. And it's got lyrics. John Hartford recorded that song. I think he may have played it and sang it. I just really love that melody.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to produce the version of that song with the Tennessee Mafia Jug Band on an album of Civil War music that I was part of. And just always been a fan of that tune. And it's one, you know, a lot of this, you know, well, just making a record in the first place, you just understand it. It's kind of a sort of like a journal entry, just kind of where I am right now. And that just happens to be a little melody that I've just loved playing on the guitar for the last several years and just tend to warm up with it. Or, you know, just it's one of those things that comes out of me. Just it's always kind of in the front of my consciousness that a little bit of melodic stuff, and I, you know, play it a lot. So it was just natural to try to put it on the record.
Brian, that's a great reference. It's a journal entry. I think this whole album for you is a journal entry. Number one, I don't know, and I'm just going to ask you: is this an unusual number of tunes for you to have written out of 13? I count 7 that you've written or co-written, and then you seem to sing like you found your vocal mic and you're not going to give it up again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the whole record sort of moves me further along in the journey that I've been on the last 5 or 6 years. You know, the big picture part of it has been I'm trying to get myself more involved with music that I'm, you know, deeply invested in. So that's more bands, less of the sideman thing, you know, just sort of generic Nashville recording session. I'm in a little, at this point in my life, doing a little less of that. And sort of turning back things a little towards my own writing and singing, and you know, Hot Rods fits well within that, just because I'm in the band and we write together. But you know, this general move is to keep exploring. It's something that I put off for a long time, just by being a lot of, you know, busier with other things, and didn't want to get any older and regret not doing the things that I'm doing now. And so, you know, writing more, singing a lot more have all been part of that process.
And you seem pretty comfortable singing. I mean, I don't notice on the album. I've actually seen you sing before. It's not like people are going to be blown away, but you seem really comfortable in stretching out the vocal parts of the guitar. You know, we all know, and the audience, if you're just tuning in, listening to Brian, I'm talking to Brian Sutton here, in particular about the new album, The More I Learn. But everybody knows, I don't have to recount the history of Brian Sutton's guitar artistry. But the singing to me on this album seems to be like you finally found, this is a cliche because I'm talking about your voice, but you finally found your voice, your singing voice. You seem pretty comfortable with where you're going with the vocal parts.
Well, thank you. I try to be. I, it's one of those things, because I've played guitar and put so much energy into that over the years. And I've always sung since I was a kid, but just never sort of nurtured it like I have guitars and other things. And so, you know, part of the process, and that's one of the good things about writing, is understanding the process of I sing songs that I've written usually a little better, you know, just because it's coming from a real spot. I conceive of the melody and the range, and so, yeah, it's in my favor a little more immediately when I can sing something that I've written. I don't turn down the challenge of trying to do some other song that I really love, and there's a couple of these on there too, but in general, just, you know, as a vocalist, it's something that I have been doing a lot lately and plan on doing more. I really do enjoy it.
It works really well.
Ultimately, as a musician, I feel more complete doing what I'm doing now.
Do you think it affects your... that's not a good question. It's going to affect your writing if you're writing a song, obviously, but do you think it affects the interplay between your singing of another person's song and your own songs with the guitar playing? Do you notice now that your ability, of course, you've always been a good accompanist, but accompanying yourself as a singer, how does that feel to you?
Right. Well, it was a little strange at first, to be honest, you know, because I was, you know, a lot of my filters are Doc Watson and Tony Rice and Bowman Blake, and these guys have just, you know, created art forms out of backing yourself up on the guitar while you sing. And so, and that's just, you know, to be specific, a thing that I have worked on and, you know, continue to work on. In part of the writing process, and that song, The More I Learn, that's on the new record,
right,
Title Cut, is kind of came out of that sort of energy of saying, okay, here's a little guitar part that I wrote, a melody that I actually started with on the guitar, and put lyrics to that. The Walking Across This Land tune is another one like that.
Yeah.
It's tuneful, and it's, you know, it started on the guitar, and then it sparked some lyrics, you know, later on down the road. And that's how it seems to be with me at this point. I would say that. You know. And the other big thing for me is I do look at guys like Doc Watson and Norman and even Daryl Scott, Jim O'Brien, as these just great examples of just singularity as far as vocal and instrumental kind of togetherness, just a sync. And as a result, when you see Daryl Scott live or Tim O'Brien, you don't miss a band, you know.
Right.
You know, they're going, boy, I wish there was some other thing going on right now musically. It's totally encompassed in what they're doing, and that really helps me hone my goal for what I'm trying to do as well.
The album is great. I mean, you mentioned Walking Across This Land. The More I Learn, I think, is a perfect a statement about if someone wanted to listen to one song and try to figure out where maybe you were right now. I mean, the lyrics, mm-hmm. I make a few notes as I'm preparing, and you're on the trail of a tune, and you're chasing a song. I mean, that's you. That's Brian Sutton's song right there.
Yeah, that's me.
and
the chorus, I'm sorry.
You go.
Well, just the chorus line there, I mean, that's always been one of those things that I just sort of constantly take note of, you know, as I learn things in life through being a husband and being a dad and a career guy and a homeowner and that's the story of that song is, you know, learning in the process of just kind of getting through life, you sort of reach these plateaus to only realize, yeah, there's more to do. And it's not a pressure thing. It's not like, oh gosh, I got to go do this. It's an exciting thing. That's my approach to that stuff is it's all about, you know, wanting to learn more and wanting to figure more things out and wanting to, you know, live life to the fullest, really.
You have, Brian, you have on this album a lot of great tunes that you've written. We talked about a few Backwater Blues, Arkansas Traveler, older songs, Arkansas Traveler being public domain, which are very recognizable, easy, and sort of about Backwater Blues is certainly an up-tempo, I think, fits right into the groove of a bluegrass tune. Time is Chase the Moon. That's just dead ahead bluegrass, isn't it?
Yeah, thank you. That actually came in a backstage of a Hot Rod show one night.
Oh.
Just kind of sitting around with the guitar and then I finished the song with John Randall a few months later.
You have a lot of great musicians on here. I noticed on the which are just everywhere. I mean, it's not that hard for you to get them in, and I think all the musicianship on this thing is just top. But on the, have you self-produced albums before? That was my question I was trying to find.
Yeah, most of the things I've done up to this point, I've had the reins and made most of the calls. Yeah. Sometimes I think about, and maybe it's something that I could see myself trying in the future, actually hiring a producer. I'm a little more of a control freak than I probably like to admit.
Well, and
when it comes to that.
And Brian, here's the reason I ask it on the back, as you're acknowledging all these people, by the way, there's an entire paragraph of people who get the album, there's an entire paragraph of acknowledgments of many of them are musicians, not all of them, but they're not all people that appear on this album. You're thanking people for influences, I think, from that last full paragraph, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
And back up a couple from there, you thank the members of the band that are, I'll say the band, the people playing on this album. And here's the reason I ask about the self-producing. I knew you had done that before, but here's what you say is for this album. You thank the members of the band. You say, this project was a real leap for me, and having you guys around was calming and inspiring. What was the leap part for you on this one?
A couple things. You know, the specific style and the way that we recorded this was more live. The majority of this record was recorded in a single room, with musicians standing or sitting around their respective microphones. Some of us would wear headphones for certain things, and some of us wouldn't. And so it was very kind of, I mean, at least as far as modern recording a lot these days with, isolation and all that kind of thing, we went the other way. And that's part of that leap thing. You lose control a little bit. You sort of embrace the chaos of whatever might happen. And as a producer of this record and kind of having an idea for what at least I knew that I wanted to try to do. I knew that I wanted to try to capture performance. And I kind of know myself well enough to where if I had too many options, I could re-sing everything, then I would just run it in the ground potentially. There's with music like this, and it's with it being so personal, I knew that, or at least I knew to at least trust this idea that if I can let go and just get good people around me that are fun to be around, and that I, you know, really respect and trust their musicality, and just and play into that really, and not worry about is this song good? Am I going to sing this with the same kind of quality that Tony Rice would sing, or whatever? You know, I can get inside my head very quickly with that kind of stuff. So it was just all a big effort to capture this thing a certain way, and you know, and embrace. It was the hard way to do it, really, but ultimately the best way to do it.
Okay.
And if I may say one little thing,
There
was one song where that little sort of love song playing a record where we actually worked that up in the room, and then I said, well, I'm kind of scared of this one, so let me go isolate it. Let's get isolated in case I need to re-sing this or something like that. And it lost every bit of the vibe that it had.
Okay.
And so it was just a kind of a reaffirmation that, okay, yeah, this is the right way to do this thing.
Good.
Because we were getting performances and moments, and that's what I was going for.
You mentioned Tony's name. Of course, anybody that's ever touched or listened to a guitar will. But I will tell you this, that the opening phrase of Virginia Creeper, I kept thinking, where is Tony on this record? That to me was a beautiful opening phrase, and then the melody kicks off. But I just thought the opening playing was it almost struck me as something that he did on one of the last Tony Rice Unit albums. And I'm thinking High Noon. For some reason, I keep thinking that little opening phrase to High Noon that he did, where you knew the melody was coming, and it wasn't quite stated yet, but you could hear he was approaching it.
Right.
But I just thought that was a gorgeous. I'm not saying you're trying to emulate Tony. Anybody in their right mind would, but you don't have to. But I just thought, you know what I mean? The opening part to Virginia Creeper, I just thought was a beautiful little.
Yeah.
Just
well,
really pretty.
You know, the way I've tried to embrace Tony and Doc and Norman, I mean, we're all such fans of them, but I would encourage any guitar player out there to soak up as much as you can of any of those guys, but then, you know, see what comes out of you as a result of
right.
that, too, you know, because you're in there, too. And I think a lot of bluegrass musicians, you know, sort of take on these affectations of the heroes, and that's, you know, if that's your goal, that's fine, but, you know, for me, I want to find my version of all that great stuff, because, and I do love, continually love everything that Tony and Doc and Norman, all these guys have done, but still trying to find my own
way. Yeah, you make it your own. I have to ask you this, too, before I forget, because, I know the tune Presbyterian Guitar, but I would have asked John Hartford if I'd ever had a chance. I didn't. What is a Presbyterian guitar?
I don't know.
Do you know? I know he had an interesting view of the world, but I'm thinking, what made it? You know, I mean, it's. I don't know what to say except that I always thought, well, maybe you recorded it. You would know why it's a Presbyterian guitar versus a Methodist guitar or an Episcopalian guitar. I just don't know what the significance is.
I don't know. You know. And I don't mean to sort of, you know, start describing denominations and stuff like that, but I think, you know, John's original recording of that is a little more stately than what I did. I chose to kind of get a little more kind of pocket and groove and swing to it. And so just maybe it feels a little bit like a gospel song to him.
Okay. I mean, that's probably it. It's probably that simple, but I always you don't have to know the answer to this. I just thought, well, here, I'll ask this guy, because I never saw John long enough to ask him anything about it. So.
Right. that would be a question I would ask him if I ever had.
We won't ask him that for a while. Then you do a Dylan tune, which I've played a lot on the program. I've played several cuts on the program over the last couple of weeks since I've gotten it. And then you chose as the final cut, You're Going to Make Me Lonesome When You Go. And that, you know, great Dylan tune, but I assume that you listen to Dylan and you pick that tune out for some reason as a closing tune on this album. And what can you tell us a little bit about?
You know, the choice of the placement on the album was, you know, to be specific, it kind of came down to, you know, Hills with a Head at the closer or You're Going to Make Me Lonesome. And it just felt like that You're Going to Make Me Lonesome seemed to sort of end things a little more for me. Hills with a Head even in concerts, I kind of do that last a lot of times. So it has that spot for me a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it was just kind of a choice, sort of just say, let's not leave this thing too sappy. And but the song choice itself came from my wife, actually. Most of the records that I've made, she's always been a good ear in pre-production and just saying, hey, what's this sound like to you? Does it feel like it, fits here, or is this a good key? And I've always sort of bounced stuff off of her.
Okay.
There have been other records of mine where she piped up here and there about things. And it actually started with her, but then, and I was totally aware of it because I was, been digging around Dylan catalog for a long time. And it strikes me as something that I wonder why somebody like Tony or Norman didn't do this years ago. The way the chords fall and the way the melody is.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it sort of finds itself in that lineage of a lot of Dylan tunes that have been covered by Tony, and, when he was doing Church Street Blues records and those kind of things.
And the playing's great, and I will tell you this again, it's good singing, Brian. You did a good job, I'm really happy with the way, you have to be happy with your singing, but I just think on that, because you don't do exactly like anybody, and nobody would want to, but the vocal on You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go is just different enough and expressive enough, I think, to be identifiable.
Yeah, it's weird, there's a lot of words to it, and I've been surprised, and all it really does is just, give more nod to Bob Dylan as a songwriter. There's just something about the sort of phonetic flow about it that really makes it memorable. I'm not the best at remembering lyrics. There's something about that that just sticks in my head, even though there's a ton of words, and it goes all over the place.
There are a ton of words. And if you and I could sit and write them down, I know the ones that you're thinking about, because there are times when you're thinking, guess there's an extra word in there somewhere, but when he would kind of blur those things out, but you actually make them more distinct, and it all fits. So you fit it all in, and I think, here's what I think. I'm a huge Dylan fan. I thought, that's what he was saying all those years ago.
Yeah.
Now I can hear everything that he's saying because Brian's saying all the words to it.
All right, well, good.
That's good. Good album. I appreciate your time. One more thing from the liner notes, the very last thing that you say. And I think this goes part and parcel with the album and the tone that you put in it, is I encourage everyone to stop putting their dreams on hold. Enjoy the process and the journey of learning. Now, those are your words, and I think that's what you're telling people. This album's part of that process. You're not finished yet. You're continuing to explore, and you're finding new things in yourself, and you're telling other people, maybe they don't do records. Maybe they don't perform for a living. Maybe they're not even musicians, but whatever it is, that thing inside of them that is part of their dreams, they need to reach out and try to touch it and feel it and make something of it.
Yeah. I had a conversation with Pete Warren on the road last year, and he used that term regretophobe. That's sort of driven him, and that's, I resonated with that.
Uh-huh.
That's what, sparked a lot of what ended up being this record, was just I had put things on hold, and I, like I said a little earlier, just chose several years ago to try to make more music that I was more invested in. That was part of my dream, was to not just be a sideman my whole life. I love that kind of thing, but I just knew that there was more for me, but kept putting it off, and knew that, with the regretophobe thing, I didn't want to wake anymore.
Well, good.
It's ultimately a choice. It's a leap. It's something that says this is not going to be easy. And the older you get, a lot of times the harder it is. But what I'm finding is that it's totally worth it.
Well,
and and I'm really enjoying this part of the journey. It kind of has helped me sort of reset my scope a little bit for my music and my life and all this kind of stuff.
At
42, that feels like that's a good thing. Really comfortable.
There's a lot of wisdom in the words of Doc Manjo. We all know that.
Yep.
The new album is The More I Learn. I'm talking to Brian Sutton. Brian, I know you have a website where people can find out where you're going to be and appearances and whatnot. And the album's on Sugar Hill. Thanks so much. I really appreciate having the opportunity to chat with you about it. And this is the first time I had a chance to talk to you, so I was thrilled to get this opportunity.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, Steve.
Hey, listen, I will open the show with Backwater Blues. As we close this out, if you had to choose one other tune to play at the close of your interview, which one from the album would you pick?
Oh, gosh.
It won't be the last song I ever play, so you don't. So, but if you were going to choose,
I guess, you know, that maybe the title cut from our conversation, you know, it seems like that's, you know, that's the meat of it.
I think that that was going to be my choice. If you were going to draw a blank, yeah. I was going to say, let's do The More I Learn. That's what we'll do. When we end this, we'll go right into The More I Learn so that people listening will know. Brian Sutton, thanks so much, man. Go on about your way and appreciate your time and being available. And such a great record, The More I Learn on Sugar Hill. Thanks, man.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. See you. Bye.
Okay, bye.